Locked On NBA, the biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. First, we'll go to Los Angeles to speak with William Updike of Locked On Clippers about the moves that the Clippers made at the trade deadline. We'll go to Milwaukee to speak with Eric Name of Locked On Bucks about the acquisition of Nikola Mirotic from the New Orleans Pelicans and what that means for Milwaukee moving forward. And lastly, we'll go to Boston to speak with John Corrales of Locked On Celtics about the unrest in Boston's locker room and the Kyrie Irving injury. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hi guys, and welcome back to another week of Locked On NBA. I'm your host, your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I'm also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball Podcast and the lead analyst at basketballmonster.com. Hope you guys have all recovered from the trade deadline and you've taken in all of our trade deadline stuff from the end of last week, our live show with myself and David Locke hosting and other recaps across the network as well. Today we're going to be covering a couple more things now regarding the trade deadline and some news from across the weekend. So let's get to it. I'm joined now by one of the hosts of the Locked On Celtics podcast. It is John Corrales here to talk about a Boston team who's been in the news over the last couple of days. John, let's start with the news that has happened most recently, and that is the knee injury to Kyrie Irving. It appears that the results of the scans that he had today were quite positive.
Yeah, officially day-to-day, there's no permanent damage in the knee. I couldn't tell if he bumped knees or just took a weird step trying to come around a screen in the second quarter of that game against the Clippers, but he seems to be doing okay, and we'll see if he's ready to play against Philly.
It obviously would be a huge blow if Irving was to miss time, but again, it's probably best case scenario where we're at with that injury at the moment. But of course, the results of the last two games over the last couple of days against the Clippers and the Lakers haven't gone in the favor of the Boston Celtics, and some troubling quotes coming from the locker room from Marcus Morris, with your Locked On Celtics co-host Jay King getting some pretty juicy quotes there from Marcus Morris, saying that it hasn't been fun for a long time and he watches all these other teams around the league and the guys are up on the bench enjoying everything and playing together and playing to win. And when I look at us, I just see a bunch of individuals. What do we make of that, John?
I mean, I was there for that too. I mean, there were about five or six of us there listening to him just kind of casually go off. Like, he wasn't screaming or anything like that, but he's been saying it's been a long time since I've had fun. And this is a team that's, like you said, it's full of individuals. And I think the past couple of days have really, really bothered him, blowing huge leads in horrible third quarters to the Lakers and to the Clippers. Clippers, with their revamped team, just not something that Marcus Morris is kind of cool with. And I think this kind of fits the pattern of the Boston Celtics so far this year. The past couple of months have been better, but the early season, these past two losses really go back to the early season. The first 20 games where the Celtics were 10-10 and were terrible against bad teams. The young guys, I think, especially have an issue with what Marcus Morris is saying. I mean, that in the he is referring to the individuals on this team that are kind of more going for personal goals. And the young guys like Tatum and Brown and Rozier have been the targets. And I saw that in the Clippers game especially. And in a lot of these games where the Celtics have big leads, they tend to take the foot off the gas, as the cliche goes. But because I think some of these guys who come in want to take that opportunity to get their own stats. Like, Terry Rozier, I think, in the Clippers game started to play differently. And that was a much more individual style of play. And he's not really a big ball sharer anyway. So I think what Marcus Morris is seeing is some of the stuff that's been going on from early on. It's some of the stuff that Kyrie Irving has been talking about too. Like, he's not talking about Gordon Hayward. He's not talking about Kyrie. He's not talking about Al Horford. There's only a few guys that he could be talking about. So it's these guys who are young, who want to get their accolades, who are looking for contracts in Terry Rozier, who are just looking for things in addition to winning basketball?
Marcus Morris, of course, is not the he's not going to take that pretty lightly, as we've seen throughout the season. Is this a problem, do you think, that's going to extend through the season? You mentioned earlier in the year that they had some of these issues, and they seem to right that ship. Is this something that it feels like, with what's coming out here, they've lost 10 in a row. They've only lost 2 in a row, and before that had a significant winning streak going. So is this just something that's amplified because of these comments? Is it something to be concerned about?
So I compare it to a first impression that a person makes with you. If the first impression a person makes with you is that guy's a jerk and he just happened to be having a bad day, no matter how great he's been every time you see him, the next time he snaps, it's like, oh, he's a jerk. See? And the timing and how you interact with certain people kind of colors how your opinion is. And it's like that with this team. They have spent a lot of time playing very well, but because their initial the way they came out of the gate was what it was, then that's every time they have those two losses like they did just now, everything just goes back to being the worst. It's not just two bad losses, it becomes here we go again. And when they had that little stretch, the Orlando, Miami, Brooklyn stretch, it goes here we go again, and it causes significant problems. So every time they do this, it's a big deal. Can they get out of it? They can. And the one thing from a Boston perspective that I think can be seen as a positive is every experienced person in matters like this throughout the NBA that I've heard says when the playoffs come around and you have no choice but to focus on winning, then things change a little bit. And it could be a case. It really would have to require some significant changes from the Celtics, but it would have to be a case of these guys saying, all right, fine, I've done what I needed to do to get my contract. I've done what I needed to do to get my endorsements. It's time to win. Because if we go out there in the first round or second round and lose badly, then we all look terrible. So if there's anything that can get them to change, it would be that.
The other thing that we need to talk about with this Boston team is across the trade deadline, the three other top East teams, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Toronto Raptors, and even to a degree, the Indiana Pacers are getting Wes Matthews off the buyout market. They all made big moves. The Bucks acquiring Mirotic, the Raptors acquiring Marc Gasol, the Philadelphia 76ers acquiring Tobias Harris, and Boston traded away Jabari Bird. Is that a concern amongst Boston fans, or the way you see this team, is that they just didn't make any move while the other teams around them all got either better or significantly better?
If they weren't in the running for Anthony Davis, then yeah, it would be concerning. But they are, and they're not going to trade away anything that jeopardizes the pursuit of Anthony Davis. So with that in mind, I understand why they didn't do anything. They could have potentially tinkered around the edges. They could have possibly moved Terry Rozier, that now that he's a restricted free agent, and did some tinkering around the edges there. But in the end, they didn't. And what they're just going to rely on now for the rest of the season is that they can try to get that internal improvement. Now, obviously, the past two games don't make that very promising, but Milwaukee, Toronto, Philly have done great things, but Boston is uniquely constructed, I think, to exploit some of those things. They can still put Al Horford on one of those bigs in Milwaukee. Like he can play Brook Lopez off the floor. And the Celtics have attacked Mirotic when he was in New Orleans to a point where he was unplayable. So there are ways for the Celtics to play the Bucks and be competitive in that series. Same with Toronto. I mean, Marc Gasol is a great pickup for them, but at the same time, there are weaknesses defensively that I think the Celtics can exploit. Of course, all of this is dependent on the Celtics playing at their best. The one thing this season has taught us is the Celtics do tend to play their best against the best teams. They've gone out there against Golden State, and it was a battle till the very end. They've beaten Toronto already. They've beaten Milwaukee already. So they do step up against these top teams, and I think, just going back to the earlier conversation, it probably leads to more of the frustration on the fans' part because they tend to let up against the worst teams. But the East has gotten better. Boston, if they do end up playing their best basketball, can play a style that can make them very competitive in those series and make those probably 7-game series that the Celtics have a good chance to win.
All right, so it's going to be interesting to see how this all pans out with all these Eastern teams really loading up and Boston, you know, looking to coalesce and get everything together and working as we thought it may throughout this season. Everything will be covered, of course, over on Locked On Celtics. John, thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
You got it, anytime.
I'm joined now by one of the hosts of the Locked On Clippers podcast. William Updike is here with me. The Clippers, William, made a lot of moves over the trade deadline and the days leading up to it. Their roster almost unrecognizable from where it was at this time last week. How do you think, what does this mean for this franchise? A lot of us are assuming it means they're punting on the playoffs this season. They're looking to build up assets for big moves, whether it's trades or free agency. Is that how it looks to you?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit confusing because I feel like after the first trade, obviously trading off Tobias Harris, I think pretty easily our best player throughout the season thus far, especially with Gallo out, it would appear pretty apparent that we were looking to punt on the season and definitely just stockpile assets. However, I was a little bit surprised after the Avery Bradley trade with the pickup of Garrett Temple and Jamichael Green, because it just made me feel like we were intending to upgrade a couple of reserve spots, obviously filling the hole for Mike Scott and adding a little bit more offensively potent wing to the mix. So I think that I think that the intention is still most likely to retain the draft pick, but it appears that they definitely want to be competitive while doing so.
Yeah, that is interesting. Those guys like Temple, and Temple straight into the starting lineup in his first game as a member of the Clippers as well, taking that small forward spot that Avery Bradley was having that Tobias Harris had before. That seemed a little bit strange. I thought that it meant, we're going to see what happens over this time frame here. They also waived Milos Teodosic and Marcin Gortat as well, acquiring Ivica Zubac to be their starting center. I thought we were going to see a lot more of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And his minutes in that first game against the Celtics weren't necessarily sky high, but he played pretty well. What do we make of the Gortat waving, I guess? Because from an outside perspective, he struggled majority of this season, and Zubac seems to be a clear upgrade. Is that how you guys see it?
Yeah, I see it as an upgrade. I appreciated Gortat's time here. I thought he was a consummate professional, despite having some issues. Obviously, when we were taking back more players than we were trading out, it became pretty apparent that we were going to cut people. I was surprised, actually really surprised, that the Gortat cut came before we got word of Milos being cut. But you know what makes sense? I think Zubac is great. It feels like after this trade deadline, the team is trending in a young direction. Obviously, a lot of picks and assets, some solid young players and projects that we can kind of develop and see where they're at the end of this year and include them in any sort of trades for like a larger star.
So who's the main guy on this team now? Are we just looking to Danilo Gallinari as being that major piece for the rest of this season to shoulder so much of that offensive load that Tobias Harris was shouldering? Or are we going to see things working in a little bit of a different direction? How did it work in that first game, post-deadline, in that huge comeback against the Celtics?
Yeah. Shamit was huge. It's really hard to pick who is the go-to guy now. I mean, obviously, I want to say Gallo. He's proved himself as a scorer for so long. I think, though, that we'll see more and more minutes of Shai obviously running the offense. He's had his ups and downs, but I think that the biggest kind of hurdle to his development this season has just been he's been on a really short leash in terms of Doc's rotations. If he has a couple bad pass turnovers or something, we see him benched for long periods of time. And even last night, you still saw him benched for a period of time. He did end up playing more minutes than he's averaged throughout the rest of the season. But, I think that the key is if we really want to develop these guys, we got to let these younger players be in more of go-to positions, have them getting those reps in those big minutes, and not strictly deferring to our closeout guys, Gallo, or obviously like Lou Will, who I personally feel like we tend to lean on too heavily in games. And if the intention is to try and retain our draft pick, obviously that opens up even more spot for those young guys to kind of prove themselves in a leadership role. Obviously Shamit, maybe some more minutes for Jerome if he's able to step up, and Ty Wallace if he could play effectively in the three guard role.
do you think that Jerry West and Lawrence Frank made the move of trading Avery Bradley away so that Doc Rivers wouldn't be playing him 30 minutes a night? So it's just taking that decision out of Doc's hands and giving minutes to these other guys rather than relying upon Bradley, who by almost all objective measures was probably the worst starter in the NBA this season. And Doc seemed to have an unhealthy reliance on him, playing him, as you mentioned, benching Shea for one mistake, but Bradley went out there and put up consistently bad performances, and Doc would be ready to jump down anyone's throat who was willing to criticize him. Do you think that part of that move was them just saying, well, Doc, if you're going to keep playing him at the expense of other guys, we're just going to get rid of him?
You know, that's a really interesting take. I guess I hadn't thought about it in that way, and it's been perplexing to the entire fan base all season why he's gotten so much freedom to play. Early on, obviously, we thought it was to bolster his trade value because he's obviously on a very team-friendly contract. But when it became apparent that the more playtime we were giving him definitely wasn't upping his value, it possibly even had the opposite effect. It became very worrisome, the amount of minutes. You know, he averaged 30 minutes here per game as his time as a Clipper. And yeah, it became very worrisome that these minutes weren't going to other people. So I do think that if that was the intention of the front office, that was a great move in a very diplomatic way to solve that situation. I don't know, you know, I don't know how Doc would feel about that personally, if that's like overstepping the bounds of the role. But I think that, you know, he for whatever reason, gets attached to players. He gets attached to lineups in a way that I think inhibits some of his like flexibility and decision making in terms of the lineup. So if that was the intention of the front office, I think that was definitely a necessary intervention.
Because we could talk about Bradley on this team, which he's not anymore, but he was probably the fourth best guard on this team behind Gildas Alexander, Lou Williams, and Patrick Beverley, yet averaged the most minutes out of that group. Now, you've mentioned briefly Landry Shamet, who came across in that Tobias Harris trade and had a very, very interesting first game. As a member of the Clippers, he was fantastic. Do you think that he is ahead of Jerome Robinson, the Clippers lottery pick, who play, I guess, a similar role, a two guard who maybe can play up to the three a little bit, maybe handle the ball a little bit, but basically just going out there and being that threat as a three-point shooter? How far ahead does Shamet feel at the moment?
Currently he feels at least a full NBA season ahead of Jerome. You know, I think that Jerome has had some upside, and he's already had some good games given his limited minutes. Landry has just gotten a lot more experience. He's gotten experience, you know, on a team that's obviously a contender. And he, you know, he's shouldered a significant role for a rookie there, obviously leading all rookies in terms of shooting percentages from three. So I do think that he is gonna take over some of Jerome Robinson's minutes. I personally would even like to see him maybe in the starting lineup, just to see what he can do, given the uncertainty of like where the direction of this team is. If we're focused on retaining a pick, or if we're focused on being competitive. And honestly, in either situation, I think that Shamet could potentially get a starting spot. And if not, he will be playing significantly more minutes than Jerome with the second unit. Jerome, you know, has a lot of upside. I guess the biggest tools that he would have over Shamet would just be like his build and size. And I think that he could defensively end up being a better tool than Shamet. But, you know, like as a catch and shoot guy and I don't even know how to explain it. He just knows where to get to. He knows how to get shots. His release is so quick, and his form looks so, so good that I think that it's going to be probably another an NBA season from now until we're kind of talking about Jerome maybe in these same terms.
All right, William, it's been an interesting time for the Clippers. Get used to a whole bunch of new players and new lineups and new scenarios on this team as they try and remake their roster heading into free agency in July, and of course the NBA draft as well. You can check out William along with his co-host Charles on Locked On Clippers. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Josh.
Now I'm joined by the host of the Locked On Bucks podcast, Eric Name, is here to talk about Milwaukee, the team that is the best team at the moment currently in the Eastern Conference, well, according to me and according to the record. And they made a move to get even stronger at the trade deadline, trading away 4 second-round picks, Stanley Johnson, who they acquired earlier in a Thon McCare deal, in order to acquire Nikola Mirotic of the New Orleans Pelicans, who is currently injured. Now, Eric, this is a huge move for this team. Mirotić was excellent in last season's playoffs. We saw him dismantle the Portland Trailblazers. He put up good numbers against the Warriors, and now he looks to strengthen this second unit of the Milwaukee Bucks team, just providing even more spacing and even more shooting and even more offensive firepower.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty straightforward deal. It sounded like the Bucks and John Horst had kind of targeted Mirotić throughout all of this and hoped that he would be someone that they could get into Milwaukee. And, you know, when you dig into the numbers on kind of the way he plays a little bit, I think all of it becomes incredibly obvious. You look at what Brook Lopez has done in Milwaukee, and, you know, if you've watched the Bucks at all this year, you've seen Brook Lopez just putting up all the threes from all over the floor and, you know, really spacing the floor out. And when you dig into it, you know, there's just 14 players in the NBA that have taken five or more threes per game from 25 to 29 feet. Obviously, the NBA line at 23 feet, 9 inches, 25 to 29 feet. Mirotić is one of them. The other, Lopez falls just short at 4.8 of those attempts per game. But the big thing in Milwaukee is not just that you're spacing teams out to the three-point line. Brook Lopez's toes are almost never on the line when he takes one. It's always deeper than that. You're not just spacing the floor to 24 feet. You're spacing the floor out to 30 feet. And when you're trying to think through why Giannis has been so successful at the rim, why Eric Bledsoe's had his best season at the rim in the entirety of his career, those are the reasons why. There's just so much space for anyone that's attacking in this Bucks offense, whether it's Giannis, whether it's Eric Bledsoe, whether it's Chris Middleton, Malcolm Brogdon, no matter who it is, there's just space on the floor, and Brook Lopez has been a huge part of that. And now if teams want to go small, if they want to put Brook Lopez in compromising positions, well, the Bucks will go small as well. And now they can go small with a guy in Mirotić, who's 6'10", 250 pounds, still has some bulk and still play a little bit of five. And you've just essentially for 48 minutes decided that at the five spot, you will stretch teams out to 30 feet. And there just is not really anyone else in the NBA that can stretch the floor out to that extent at that position.
So basically, we had DJ Wilson playing those backup 4 or 5 minutes with, you know, maybe 5 or 6 minutes of Ersan Ilyasova, who'd seen his minutes cut pretty dramatically over the previous couple of weeks. So Mirotić comes in here and takes basically Ilyasova's minutes and takes some of those away from DJ Wilson. Now, a lot of people, Eric, who may not have dug as much into Mirotić lately or have seen as much of him play, will be going, yeah, but he's going to get you killed on the defensive end. That's not true. He's not a terrible defender. In fact, he can be a good defender in many situations. He's not also just a spot-up shooter. So just, you want to bring us anything about, you know, some of those misconceptions that tend to be around what Mirotić is able to do?
Yeah, the article I wrote over at The Athletic, kind of what I did was, as soon as I saw that deal was coming through, I went through and watched film from, you know, 3 or 4 of his games and kind of dug all the way through it. And, you know, there's just the game that really stuck out to me was Pelicans versus Warriors. And it was one of his best nights of the season offensively, but defensively, you know, for the most part, he really managed to handle a Warriors team, which has in many ways become the standard for, oh, this guy is fine in the regular season, but in the playoffs, can he defend blank? That blank has been filled with the Golden State Warriors now for 3 or 4 years. So, you know, can he stay on the floor in Game 7 against the Warriors? And there were certainly times where the Warriors were able to get a switch from Mirotić onto Steph Curry, and, you know, Curry was able to do some work, but the Bucks don't really switch all that easily. It's not something that they like to do. So the two times that they've played the Warriors, they haven't really switched a lot. They've just had Bledsoe get over the top of screens and had let the bigs kind of corral anyone else that's coming through there. So for what Mirotić was doing in New Orleans, it's not all that similar to what he'd be doing elsewhere. And like you said, there's, I don't want to say it's a misconception necessarily, but, you know, I do at least think there's some thought that he isn't, he isn't playable defensively. He isn't passable defensively. And that's just not true. He's more than passable defensively. I'm not going to say he's a great defender, but he can definitely play defensively, and he's not going to be a problem for this Bucks team in the playoffs. So I think those are two big things. And then, you know, also when you watch him, there's his instincts offensively help him be a more complete player. And he's not someone that's going to, you know, pump fake and drive to the rack and dunk on three people. And, you know, he's not crazy athletic or anything, but he can attack a closeout. He can make a play out of that. And I think his passing is kind of underrated just because he has such a good feel for the game. He's not put in a lot of playmaking situations, but he is able to make passes on target within an offense. And I think that'll be huge for him in Milwaukee.
And Milwaukee currently holds a one-game lead on the Raptors for the one seed in the Eastern Conference. Toronto also made a move to get Marc Gasol. Obviously, you're going to have a lot of thoughts on the Milwaukee side of things. Which team do you think got better? Or got better by the largest degree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really tough. I thought going into this trade deadline, the scary thing for the Bucks would be everyone else in the East being able to make moves and the Bucks not being able to match it. And, you know, kind of through working around the margins, John Horst was able to add a couple extra second rounders and eventually put together a package of 4 second rounders that would go over to get Mirotić in Milwaukee. And, you know, I didn't think they'd be able to make that move. So I thought, you know, you would see the Sixers jump over them. You'd see the Raptors jump over them. You know, maybe you'd even see the Celtics jump over them. But Celtics didn't make a move. Those other two teams did. And you thought, you know, there's probably not a good chance that the Bucks can actually do anything to match this. And, you know, in many ways they did. I think when you look at Gasol, when you look at Tobias Harris, undeniably better players than Mirotić. I don't think there's any argument for all of that. But where Mirotić is different than those two is those two teams are going to have to make changes. They're going to have to move things around. They're going to have to find a fit for those players, while the Bucks are just going to plug and play. Like, everything that Mirotić does is what they're looking for. He fits perfectly in Milwaukee. There's not really any awkwardness. And, you know, I think with the Raptors, you're trying to figure out, okay, what happens to Ibaka? He's had a great season at center. Are you going to move him down to power forward and that's where he's going to play all the time? Well, then how does that affect Pascal Siakam's minutes? How does that affect Danny Green's minutes? How does that affect Kawhi Leonard? Like, how does that affect all those people? And, you know, in Philadelphia, you're thinking the same thing. They haven't really been able to make it work with 3 stars, and now you're adding a 4th star in there, and how awkward does it get there? So I think with the Bucks, I think they added the least talented player among those three teams, but they added the player that fits the best among those three teams. And I think you have to try to figure out how all of that works out in the aggregate.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think it probably is the smoothest and most seamless fit. And we'll see. We haven't seen Mirotić make his debut here for the Bucks as he's dealing with that calf injury that's kept him out for the last couple of weeks before the deadline. Eric, you'll have all of that covered when he does finally play for Milwaukee over on Locked On Bucks. And thank you for joining us here today on Locked On NBA.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
And that wraps up another episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you guys are following us on both Instagram and on Twitter at Locked On NBA Net. And where you subscribe to this podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, or on Spotify, if you could leave us a 5-star review, that would be absolutely fantastic. Go ahead and do that. Remember, my name is Josh Lord. You can follow me personally on Twitter at RedRock_Beeble. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.